Good morning. I'm Julian Bleeker. This is Nicholas Nova.
Hi.
And we put together a little discussion presentation about this idea of the mind and consciousness as a user interface. And we did this because I think there's an evolution of the semantics that go into the design of user experiences and user interfaces that tends towards these kind of sort of vague idioms of sort of more direct interface, more direct interaction. And if you sort of pay attention to these things, they're very curious tendencies where we're meant to have sort of more control over what our devices do, what our computers do, whether it's a touch interface or whether it's a mind control interface. The semantics around it are that thought becomes very tightly coupled to the actions that are exhibited by our devices. So we're able to articulate our ideas and have them happen on the computer. And it's a very interesting sort of trajectory in these modern times. But there's also a lot of sort of interesting precedent for it, both historically, but then also in the sort of speculative literature, both scientific, science fact, and science fiction. And so what we're going to do this morning is share with you some of our insights and sort of observations, our point of view on this, and then also show you some of that evidence, some of those little snippets of things that actually exhibit this tendency and that hopefully get us thinking in a different way about what user interfaces could be and the ways in which we control our devices. And so I'm going to start by pressing that button. So I'm a big fan of science fiction and science fiction film, and not just as a sort of normal fan, but as someone who looks at it for ideas and inspiration, but then also ways of thinking, rethinking about what the kinds of technologies that a lot of people who come to these kinds of events are curious about or actually developing, and using it as a way to essentially sketch through some of the possible scenarios in this kind of thing. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to sort of give you a schema of exemplars from science fiction that represent, for me, a relationship across the spectrum of degrees of control that science fiction imagines that we might have over the world around us. And that runs from very directly coupled, in other words, the interfaces connected to our brains, to very loosely coupled, where a gesture might actually control something. And then after that, Nicholas is going to sort of carry on and sort of present some of the things that are maybe science fiction, maybe science fact, but are outside of the science fiction literature. So the first example, so these are going to be sort of examples that I used to teach film, and so these are ways of sort of bringing up discussion. So this is a clip from a film called Surrogates. And what's curious in this clip is that we now sort of discover that humanity is able to control sort of cyborg representations of itself. So we see the wonderful Bruce Willis in an amazing role, basically bringing himself a cup of water. And so that's the replicant, and then the one on the couch is the human. What's going on in this film is that there's been a sort of evolution of humanity, so now we're able to interpret the signals, the patterns that the brain produces, and use it to create essentially directly manipulable cyborg representations of ourselves. And the opening clip of the film sort of describes this. Oh, that's a good idea. Oh, there isn't. I'm trying.
Fail.
Disabled people will be able to operate fully synthetic bodies. It provides a tremendous amount of hope for the future.
And so this is the trajectory that humanity has evolved over, which is very familiar.
At a time of war, we're going to start seeing this more and more.
As manufacturing capacity expanded for military and industrial use, surrogates became affordable to the general public, causing a revolution in how we live.
The ability to leave your home without risk of disease or injury, to have perfect looks without trips to the gym or plastic surgery.
There's no question that at some point there will be persons like anyone else. They will not be human, but that they will be part of our community, there's no question in my mind.
The decision came down 5-4 that the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the use of surrogates in daily life.
Right now, we are witnessing an event that is of an evolutionary significance.
According to VSI, the industry's leading manufacturer, over 98% of the world population uses surrogate in all facets of their daily life.
We're in the midst of profound changes. The things that were once unimaginable have become inevitable.
Since the global embrace of surrogacy, crime rates have dropped to record lows.
We have witnessed an incredible reduction in violent crime, communicable disease, and discrimination. Problems that have plagued societies for centuries, solved almost overnight.
We are the creators. We will be making them
do everything for us, all in one machine.
But there is a minority who actively oppose surrogates and are moving to limit their use.
Many people will see this as the invasion of the inhuman.
They've established reservations or surrogacy-free zones in major cities around the country.
They are led by Zaire Powell, or as he is better known.
So I think the core bit of the drama obviously centers around the kind of conflict that people have with this idea that we would allow our consciousness to sort of be infused in these surrogate bodies. I think the interesting aspect of this and sort of the relevance to the mind and consciousness is that this sort of represents to a lot of people sort of like the natural kind of end goal of the evolution of our ability for our mind to be able to control the world around us. And I think maybe the bit where it says life only better is probably the part that captures that sense of hubris that we will be able to read the patterns of our brains, interpret those signals in such a way that we can actually make them control something as you know, hubristic as ourselves, where life is only better. And so this idea of being able to control the patterns or understand, interpret the patterns of our mind is one that's recurrent, I think, in both the science fact and the science fiction literature, where you might have the ability to understand or sort of comprehend what it is that your mind is doing, interpret those signals, and be able to record them, and then perhaps in some way play it back. So in Wim Wenders, Until the End of the World, this is the crux of the technology, that they're able to have these systems that can record the patterns in our minds and use them, record them first, but then later on be able to play them back so that other people can exhibit them. And then the conflict that occurs is that if you're able to record thoughts, you're able to record people's dreams, and then you get into this whole very complex sort of existential dilemma about, do you want to know the secrets of someone's life? And I think Nicholas and I, as we were preparing this talk over the last few weeks, we were discussing, like, what is it about this that maybe what are the questions or issues that are sort of raised most saliently in this? And that is that if we were able to use our thoughts to control things by interpreting those patterns, at some level those patterns are revealed, and we might need to control our thoughts sufficiently so that our computers don't do absolutely insane things, because our mind's wandering. Your minds are wandering now in various directions. You're thinking about, you know, why didn't you get that cup of coffee? Or you're thinking about, this is an interesting talk. I need to remind my colleague to look more into this topic. But if you were trying to control a computer, you might actually have to very tightly couple your thoughts so you're only on a single track. So I'm speculating here. But if that were the case, then where does our imagination go? If we train or develop or evolve the capacities of our minds to control objects, or to control robots, or to control cars, certainly when you're driving a car, you don't want to start thinking about other things that it could make your car fall off the cliff. And so this is, this is just one sort of thing to consider in this context, is that if our minds are able to control things out there in the world, how does that constrain the nature of our thought to the degree that our minds don't wander? And I happen to believe that sort of minds wandering is a very important thing. So this is another sort of exemplar from film. It's I think a very important film, that's sort of underrated, called Brainstorm. And I think this is one of the early films to actually represent this idea that thoughts can be recorded on this kind of like, you know, huge magnetic or tape, and then sort of played back and commercialized, instead of all the usual complications and drama ensue that, you know, the military becomes involved and very evil albino military program directors are trying to take over the technology and use it for nefarious purposes.
God. That's remarkable.
I seem to have lost my
audio. One-of-a-kind scientific breakthrough.
Could you just leave that up?
Wonderful. We'll have to tell the division heads. And Karen, maybe we can modify it, simplify it even a little more.
Oh, yes. That's already in the works.
Good. We'll need to make a demo tape. We want to show the potential for travel and education and news. Can we do that, Mike, in the conference room?
We could pump it right through the phone.
Excellent. Thank you. You've blown communication as we've known it right out of the water. You know that, don't you? And I'm very proud of all of you. You blew my socks off.
So, parenthetically, you know, oftentimes in a lot of these, especially contemporary, you know, ones that are set in the here and now science fiction films, you find out the ways in which these technologies sort of evolve and develop, and they do a wonderful, remarkable job of taking a normal audience, an audience that might not be familiar with even the principle of, like, well, our brains produce patterns, and those patterns can be interpreted and perhaps recorded. They sort of bring you along that trajectory, and I think this is one film that does it particularly well, especially for this idea of what the mind is able to do and what current science is beginning to speculate. That is, that if we put enough sensors on the top of someone's head, the brain is producing very faint signals, but perhaps we can amplify them and then amplify them and make some sort of sense out of that, you know, initially a cacophony of sort of signal, and lay some patterns on it and lay enough patterns that we can understand how to basically inject those signals back into someone's brain. So you have this kind of I/O two-way interface, so the things that have been done can be then piped back into your brain again. This is... some of you might be familiar with this wonderful series called Black Mirror.
Airport, please.
Live. Breathe. Smell.
So in this clip, what's going on is that there are these devices, sort of implants, and they sort of, you know, they're showing you in a kind of didactic way what this implant's meant to do, so you can enjoy the rest of the drama. But essentially, it records all your memories and thoughts. And so what has happened is that we've, you know, in this interpretation, it's gone from a helmet that you might wear that you saw in the previous clips to something that actually just sort of fits behind the ear, and it's recording all the signals from your brain for later playback. And there's a drama that goes on that's not relevant to what we're talking about here. But I think that the interesting thing is that there's you know, we started the kind of, you know, close to invasive side of where that point of control might be with the brain. So whether it's sitting on the skull, or Nicholas will show you some very gooey pictures later of actually inside the skull, or just sort of subtly behind the ear in a kind of, it almost looks like a sort of outpatient procedure. You have that evolution of things. And what I want to show you next is that in the science fiction canon, there's also been this idea that it might be something where it's sort of action at a distance. So it might not be connected to you, but you're able to sort of exhibit those kinds of powers of being able to read a mind or project onto a mind just using your hands.
Thank you.
know.
Okay, super intense, evil Spock. The interesting thing here that I find fascinating is that, you know, humanity is sort of struggling with this way of being able to have more control over the world around us. I shouldn't say humanity. Western civilization, to a large degree, wants control, wants to be able to exert control, and there's this sort of fantasy of being able to do it either with our hands or just with our minds or with an evil eye. And these tropes of being where that sort of source of control comes from is fascinating to me. And it's, of course, it's even in the sort of normal kind of the human potential movement. So this idea that you can use your hand to basically, in this case, sort of treat yourself or treat others. And there are actually degrees of body work that happen that are essentially canonizing this kind of principle that my hands are the source or locus of power, as in Reiki treatments, or maybe even sort of, you know, going a little bit further, one could actually do Reiki at a distance, so you don't even need to be proximate. And so, you know, I should say, full disclosure, my mother is a Reiki master, and anytime I'm sick, she was like, I'll send you some Reiki. And my sort of inside joke is like, do I need to turn on the fax machine? Like, how does this actually work? But there is that sense that, you know, our minds are able to control the world in some fashion. And to a large degree, there's actually very interesting work that's gone on by scientists. And so these are like proper scientists who are, they used to be, you know, former deans of Princeton College of Engineering, and these kinds of things that are looking at the way, in sort of very serious, very diligent way, looking at the ways in which the human mind can exert control over the world. And so they, the famous infamous, depending on your perspective, PEAR Lab, Paranormal Experiments and Anomalies Research, looked at the ways, did these exhaustive studies looking at the ways in which people could control, essentially it's a Galtrin machine, so basically it's a giant pachinko machine that over time creates a normal curve of ball bearings falling down. And they saw what they saw as a statistically significant control that subjects would have over 25 years of doing these experiments, like some minuscule amount. So make it go down a little bit, and people would sort of sit there and look at it and concentrate, and they found this effect. And then that sort of blossomed into this global consciousness movement where these recorders that were looking for deviations in supposedly random number generators would measure influence of the sort of global collective consciousness when significant events happened in the world. So people waiting for the O.J. Simpson verdict in the short bit of time before the September 11th World Trade Center tragedy. So these are very interesting ways in which the science fiction begins to blur into the science fact. And of course, we know that science fiction is basically, you know, sort of scientists sort of hoping for what they, you know, what they believe in to actually exist in the world. And then there's sort of, you know, of course, we have the famous Jedi mind trick, which is another sort of exemplar of this kind of level of control.
You don't need to see his identification.
We don't need to see his identification.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for.
You can go about his business.
You can go about your business.
Move along.
Move along. Move along.
And so you find these kinds of tropes of just that hand gesture. So that is the locus of control where things happen. And
don't be too proud
sort of have to show
this technological
this.
Terror you've constructed. The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant next to the power of the Force.
Don't try to frighten us with your sorcerer's ways, Lord Vader. Your sad devotion to that ancient religion has not helped you conjure up the stolen data tapes or given you clairvoyance enough to find the rebels' hidden fort.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Enough of this. Vader, release him.
As you wish.
And so again, it's that, it's the hand that is the place where the control comes from. And these are often the things that we think about when we think about direct interface. So I think touch is probably just that example. Like, these are the great manipulators that we've been given. It must be the place where we're able to exert control over the world around us. Okay, so I think that the thing to sort of pay attention to in this context is that that there's certainly a trajectory of these things where we, to a certain degree, want to find out, you know, want to exert our control over the world around us, and we just want to find where that locus of control comes from. And so I think that idea of being able to exert our consciousness on the world is one that, in a very serious way, should sort of be paid attention to by interaction design, interaction designers. And so now Nicholas is going to share with you some of the science fact.
No sound. Okay, thanks, Julian. So Julian presented some sort of cultural backdrop for brain-computer interaction, or how the mind and consciousness can be used as an interface. What I want to show now is more the here and now, the existing project in that area, and show you the opportunities and the limits in terms of interaction design, because obviously this kind of technology is going to be mainstream at some point, and there will be a need for designers to address this kind of project. So what I want to start with is a very basic project that exists already. So this is this is the first tweet sent using a brain-computer interaction. It's kind of the hello world for the mind and consciousness as an interface. It says using EEJ to send tweets. I'll get back to what EEJ means, but that's obviously one of the first example. Second example that I find interesting is this video from a monkey using a robotic arm controlled by his brain to feed himself. So the ape is generating brain patterns so that the movement of the arms bring food to his mouth. Interesting example of another kind of user, which is an animal. And the next one is my favorite. Maybe you saw that in the previous month. It's called Nikomini by a Japanese company called NeuroWare. Tiny bunny ears that you put on your head. And depending on your brain and mental activity, you can move the ears. Nice equations. Brains equals ears. And depending on what you do, your emotion are reflected on the on the device. So if I had to ask you for the three examples, so is the first example true, the true one? Show hands, please. Is the first one true? Right. Yeah, the first one is true. The second one, the animal, the ape, is that a real one? Yes. Thank you. And the last one. Okay, less people, but it's actually true. It's not a fake. It's not a hoax. It's a very weird Japanese technology, but that exists. So what I want to do now is to start from what Julian said about the this kind of trope, this notion of direct translation, that the brain activity can be turned into some sort of communication pathway to lead to external interactions. That's if you take all the definitions about brain-computer interactions, you will get this kind of direct link. And this is interesting because it's not just about the mind and consciousness as the interface. It's a very common trajectory in human artifact or human object interactions, and levers, the mouse, voice interactions, they are all steps along this kind of trajectory that tries to make the interaction more direct between the user and the external world. And that's it's not just a cultural backdrop that Julian said. It's something that is very common in the way we use interfaces. And what is important in the context of the mind and the consciousness as an interface is that it's not that easy. There are basically two ways to do it. The first one, not safe for work. The first one is this, is to use what is called invasive technologies by opening people's skull and putting different kind of sensors directly in the brain.
That's really gross.
Yeah, but that's science.
Bad idea.
So the sensor is directly implanted in the user's brain, which is it's quite good because of the what's called the temporal and the spatial resolution of the sensor detection. It means that you can collect very precisely the brain activity at certain places in your brain, and on a very regular basis. The problem is that, well, you have to do this, and the clamp is very, very gooey. So it requires surgery, and once you've put the sensor, you cannot move it. And that kind of technology is very common. It's common now in research about how to help people with disabilities and to use their brain as a direct interface. And for people who can't use their legs or their hands. Fortunately, there are other kind of technologies that do not require to open up our skulls, and it's called non-invasive. EEG is one. I'll get back to this afterwards. There's also functional magnetic resonance imaging for the lucky people like me who had the chance to go into this huge device, which is super noisy. This basically tracks the flow of your blood in the vessels in your brain, and based on this, it can derive some information about your brain activity in different parts of the brain. So it's a common tool, but as you can see, it's not very easy to use that in a different context than in an hospital. So this is the more common tool called EEG, which means electroencephalography, and it's based on the idea that the brain generates electrical activity, and depending on sensors that you can put on the brain with gel that you can put under the sensor, you can detect this kind of activity. Of course, it's less accurate than the sensor that is directly implanted in the brain, but still, it's quite convenient, and you can detect interesting brain pattern. And most of the research in brain-computer interactions is based on this kind of technology. And of course, it's kind of difficult to set these electrodes on your head, you need gel. If you have 30 electrodes, it takes a lot of time. The companies which are into development of products like this one, they try to minimize the number of electrodes. So that's called a dry cap helmet or dry cap headset. It's dry because you do not have to put gel, and you only have only three different sensors in different parts of the brain. And as you can see, there's also a sensor on the ear to detect the heartbeat as a way to complement the information. So when you use this kind of technology, what you get is this kind of standard brain activity representation made of waves depending on the location of the electrode or the sensor. And the point of designing interactions with this is to make sense of this kind of mess. It can be felt as messy if you do not know cognitive psychology in your sciences, but some people manage to make sense out of that by looking at different kind of waves. For instance, there are delta waves, theta waves. I won't enter into much details about that, but depending on the amplitude and the shape of the wave, you can detect a specific activity and a specific mental state, which can be used afterwards for creating meaningful interaction. And the process, I can't resist using the slides that researchers and engineers do with this kind of domain. You have this kind of representation, that one with a sort of squeezed head that I find fascinating, or this one that is kind of complicated. The point is to take the brain activity, analyze this activity by different kind of algorithm, classification algorithm, to make sense of this and turn that into an interaction that that can be done by a motor, LEDs, a screen, or whatever. So once you have done that, you can do pretty much a lot of application that we tried to classify with Julian. So obviously there are a lot of different possibilities. One that is not on this slide, but that is very important, and I already mentioned it. It's to use that kind of technology for people with disabilities. But you have now more and more research labs and companies looking into the use of this as a way to create new sorts of interactions. And gaming is obviously an important field. Serious games, spelling applications, 2D cursor control, access to dreams or consciousness is something that is, as you saw in the movies that Julian presented, is very important. Training programs. If you look at the box of the NeuroSky mindset cap that I showed previously, the way the headset is marketed, it's to help your kids to learn mathematics and arithmetics with a different kind of exercise that, in which their brain is involved, and you can monitor their activity based on the brain. And it's interesting to see that this kind of serious games or training programs are trying to be expanded based on this kind of technology. This is an example of a touch-free interface. So you sit in your chair with the headset, and you can select the different kind of letters on the keyboard, on the virtual keyboards, and then write your name. That was one of the first application that was implemented using this technology, and it's based on this kind of action at distance that Julian mentioned, and it's more and more deployed in context in which in environment in which it's difficult for people to interact with their hands. Military people are interested in this. That's a crazy project I found recently called the Mind Control Parachute to trigger the launch of the parachute by thinking about it. I don't exactly know the accuracy of this kind of technology. I would be completely freaked out using it, but that's obviously something that is done. Thought pattern recognition is interesting too. It's different than the examples I've shown before. It's not you thinking about something that will trigger the interaction on the screen. It's not action at distance. It's more like your brain activity is scanned, data about your brain activity is collected, and then the interface is adapted to your mental state. So there are projects, it's mostly research project, about how to adjust the level of difficulty playing a video game such as Pac-Man by using your mental state and dynamically adapt the content. And of course this is very important for people interested in serious games and training programs as a way to adapt the content and the level of difficulty of interactions. Of course, people in the military area and police area are interested in this technology as a modern-day lie detector by using, in this case, it's not EEG, it's functional magnetic resonance imaging as a way to detect lies, what is true and what is false. It's not entirely, it's not as effective as the previous technology, but that's something that is currently tested in research labs. Then you have what is called neurofeedback. Neurofeedback is based on the premise that it would be interesting for people doing a certain kind of activity to have a sort of level of awareness of their mental activity, maybe as a way to relax more or to stop multitasking and to see the effects of what happened when they're doing something. And this is an example of an application called PLX Wave, developed for the NeuroSky mindset headset, which can work on the iPhone actually. And the point of this is to safely detect the brain rhythm with the sensor, and then give the user a feedback of his mental state, his level of comfort. And you have plenty of what we call them Zen-like interfaces, which are meant to help people to, well, to relax and control their mental activity. So you have those kind of examples. There are plenty of others, but those kind of, covers the sort of typology we discovered by looking at the here and now. And it's interesting to see that they're, most of the time, they're very close to what Julian showed on the science fiction movies. And if we, as an interaction design community, if we had to take this as a material to create interaction, it's interesting to see the kind of repertoire we could build based on those data. So on this slide, I try to sketch the sort of design space, the design possibilities, and the first user experience parameter that is important to consider is this notion that the user interactions can be explicit or implicit. Explicit means the user has to think about a certain thing or do a certain thing with his brain to trigger an action in the application. So it's user-driven. But in other kind of implicit interactions, the point is to let the user do what he's doing on a regular basis and then adapt the interface accordingly. So you have this kind of... there's two sorts of interactions, control versus detect, that can be used as a starting point. Then you have what's called synchronous versus asynchronous interactions. Most of the applications I've shown are synchronous. It means that in real time, your brain activity is scanned and something happened based on this kind of data. And it would be interesting to consider what happened if we used it in an asynchronous way, if we could scan the brain of a person for a certain amount of time, one day, one week, or whatever, and use that as a way to build an application on top of that. And it's curious to see that there's nothing in that kind of area currently. Another possibility is the detection of certain cognitive states based on the brain activity. By cognitive states, I mean the level of anxiousness, the level of activity of the brain, or the different areas of the brain, and as you may know, some areas are linked to a certain kind of activity, like reading, like talking, or making movements. So you can use this also as a kind of repertoire to create interactions. And finally, as you've seen in some of the examples, sometimes it's a standalone brain-computer interface in which it's only the brain activity that control the interaction, and sometimes it's not. There's the heartbeat on the ear. As you saw in one of the movie that Julian mentioned, you can use a tiny controller in your hand, and this is interesting as a way to consider how standard interfaces can be, or other kind of physiological interfaces can be used in this sort of context. So then with the standard tools designers use, you can try to map the design space and try to see the possibilities. I try to play with this kind of thing to envision the kind of possibilities. But then we have to consider different kind of limits. There are, of course, a lot of opportunities, but this is not easy. This domain is not easy, and as in the last few slides, I have some of the problems and some of the limits we have to consider. So the first one is the big difference between detecting a cognitive state, what you are doing, versus having the whole semantic. So it's, in a way, it's easy or it's doable to know that a user is reading something based on his mental activity, but it's very difficult to know exactly the contents of what he's reading. Of course, there are counterexamples like this project that some of you may have seen that is based on the reconstruction of mental activity, the brain activity. So on the left, you have a movie that is shown to a panel of people. Their mental activity is recorded, and then this data are extracted to create the image on the video on the right to reconstruct what's in people's mind. So as you can see, there's a kind of difference between the two, but it's obviously really, really, really interesting and maybe scary too. And that exists already, but it's of course, to do this, you would need the big machine, the big noisy machine. Second limit, second problem is the notion of training. It seems very easy in on the surface of it when you see people with their headsets playing with the games, and it's actually not easy when you try this kind of stuff. When you put the helmet and you play this very basic game called Mighty Ant, in which you have to push some fruits, you play the ant, and the way you push the fruit is that you use the keypad on your laptop, and you have to have a certain kind of mindset. You have to relax, and there's this kind of interface on the left hand, the top left hand corner, that shows your level of focus, and even if there's this kind of indicator, and most of the players have asked them to play with this game, they do not know the connection between this indicator and what they have to do with their brain, simply because this is a whole new vocabulary that we have to learn, and it's really, really difficult. The presence of a feedback is there, but it's hard to connect this feedback with what you are doing. You're just trying to think about something, and then you're scratching your head, and the indicator is modified, and you do not necessarily know what happened, and you need to be trained to do that. And after a few weeks, you get better, but it's really hard as opposed to pressing button on the laptop, for instance. Third issue is noise. With EEJ, for instance, there's a lot of noise, background noise, what's happening around you, lots of data, not only what you're thinking about, but also if you're moving your hands, for instance, if you're anxious, if you grow tired, and this noise must be considered, otherwise the data are not really meaningful. And here, in most of the case, noise is perceived as a problem, but that's it would be interesting in a way to consider how this can be turned into a design pattern. There's this notion of seamful design, in which instead of trying to do to have a seamless technology, to use the limits of the technology as a way to create a meaningful interaction. That's obviously an interesting directions with this kind of technology. Fourth problem is context. In most of the brain-computer interfaces, if you see the movies, if you see the pictures, it's always in research labs. It's never considered as a way to use it in real life, except of course this kind of crazy project with the mind control skateboard. But as designers, we are of course we know that context is very important in the way people do things, in the way people's image is projected to other people. Would you want to wander around a cafe with this kind of weird helmet on your head? Would it work? Is it something that you can consider using with other people around you? Those are important questions that led to some important problems in the context of virtual reality helmets, for instance. And I would find interesting to consider them in the context of brain-computer interfaces. And of course, depending on the way you use this kind of helmets, the kind of dry cap EEJ systems, there could be a whole set of possibilities. If you look at how Bluetooth headsets are used, you can try to map out the different kind of possibilities. There could be like the standard headset, the bike head cap that you can use, the glasses. And based on these kind of form factors, it would be interesting to think about the context and the kind of interactions you can create. And it's curious to see that most of the time those questions are not addressed in the brain-computer interface research. So as a conclusion, based on what Julian presented and the different kind of elements that I showed you, so from the cultural backdrops to the here and now, the takeaways are fairly common. The first thing is that there's this direct translation trope that is very important. But it's not the end of it. There could be possibilities to go beyond that and try to envision more curious, more original interactions. Second point that I think is important is that we need to build an interaction design perspective on that, ask design issues, and not just address the technological possibilities, because most of the time it's functional, but it does not really it's not really linked to people's context, people's logic of actions, people's needs and interest. And of course, the ethical questions, the ethical issues about the mind and consciousness as an interface are very important to consider. And as Julian mentioned, it's important to ask questions such as what's the equivalent of the blue screens of death, the equivalent of Y2K, the Y2K problems with this kind of technology. What happens for social norms when you have this kind of total transparency that we haven't reached yet, but that may happen at some point? Those are important to consider. Thank you very much. So we have maybe 10 minutes for questions. So if you want to ask a question, there's a microphone in that part of the room.
Hi. So right now we have interfaces like the piano or the pen that have been around for hundreds or thousands of years that are for people to convey knowledge and experiences and beauty. And now it seems like interfaces are moving so fast that there's no time for anyone to cultivate virtuosic skill at any particular interface. So I'm wondering what you think the future of crafting beautiful experiences and absorbing them holds.
The future of it.
It's up to us.
I'm not sure what the future of it is, but I think that the point that there are these trajectories and evolutions of things. Maybe they're moving fast. Maybe that's just like I think as humans we have a our perspective of what time is or history is limited to a couple few generations. I think in some future, let's say in 10 generations from now, people will look back and they'd be like, God, it was. They'll look back maybe at the touch interface as the same way that we might look back now at the piano as an interface, is the example that you shared. So I think it's things will evolve, and I think maybe the constant, at least in sort of like a Western, very technologized kind of perspective, is that there will be this kind of hubris to drive us to more. More of whatever it is. So aside from the artistry that might go into a virtuoso pianist, there'll be this sort of aspiration like, well, why can't everyone be a virtuoso, which I think drives a lot of this stuff. So can I think of a melody and have it come out beautifully orchestrated? And you see these kinds of just aspirations. And part of that, on one perspective, is like, okay, I can understand that, and sure, why not? If we all have a song in our head, just to continue on with the music example, why shouldn't we be able to get that out and all that kind of stuff? And so you find the tools, and sometimes the tools aren't just about the ability to, say, compose music or understand the principles and fundamentals of music theory, but it's just giving people the resources and access to releasing what's in their heart and in their brain and in their consciousness. And I think that's a lot of what drives it. And so I guess the future will be this kind of continuing aspiration to being able to exhibit and articulate our will. The music example is a nice, pleasant one. There are other examples that are kind of more like, well, no, I shouldn't be able to make like a demolition rock fall into this room and wipe everyone out.
Thank you.
Hi there. Thanks for a really good talk. I just wondered, could you explain a little bit more about what you alluded to about fluctuations in global consciousness about before or prior to after September 11th?
Yeah, I can try. I can't explain the the mechanism by which it works, but there is a this group called the PEAR Lab, PEAR, at Princeton University, which just closed down a couple years ago, was set up by this fellow called Dr. John, who complete coincidence. Actually, I grew up in Princeton. He lived around the corner from me and used to play, you know, softball in the street with his daughter. It turns out he was doing this research in the basement of this lab where they had this giant Galtron machine. So it's the pachinko machine, which is just generating thousands of random occurrences. And they evolved that. Obviously, it's a very mechanical thing. But they had this living room kind of set up where they would have people sitting down, focusing on trying to make shift the deviation, make more balls go to the left. And they repeated this experiment an exhaustive number of times, so like over 25 years. So tens and thousands of these trials of this stuff, and they noticed a slight shift. And as around this activity, there was another scientist whose name escapes me, who was very interested in this and developing technology. Essentially, they call them these RIGs, REGs, random event generators, which were... rather than mechanical devices, they're electrical devices, and so they're basically generating superlative caliber noise. So exceptionally random. They couldn't, you know, they didn't repeat. And this is sort of like one of the end goals of sort of like computer science, to have, you know, completely random number. But then what they did is say, this thing is completely random by most, you know, scientific and technological measures, and they would sort of give it to you and say, like, can you influence it? Can you make it seem less random? And what the global consciousness people did is they basically had these running in different parts of the world and just sort of running and gathering this data. And when a significant event would happen, of course, they couldn't anticipate the significant event. They might look at the data, sort of scrub it back and be like, that's weird. There's a little deviation. You know, in the moments before the O.J. Simpson trial, their sort of hypothesis is that you have hundreds of millions of people who are now paying attention to something, and the random event generator doesn't know that, but the people do, and so that's their sort of control experiment. And then, you know, it's highly debated and discussed, and you can kind of get into the you know, really interesting flame wars and discussion boards about whether, you know, is the data valid, or are they just looking for the data and they're looking so hard that they actually find the influence and these kinds of things.
Do you believe in telekinesis? I mean,
sorry?
Would you say there's some scientific credence like behind the idea of telekinesis?
Well, it's that action at a distance thing. So it's influencing something. So I don't know what you would say it's influencing in this case. Is it making, you know, this little bit of technology that's generating these random numbers say, like, hold on, I'm going to not be so random for a moment. And then, yes, so the goal is the Jedi mind trick, I guess, at some point.
Can you talk about the overlay between this work and the work that's been done with meditation research?
Between meditation and what?
With meditation research.
Like the Zen-like interfaces that I've shown, for instance? Or
no... Well, the work that's been done...
Sorry about that.
That's okay. The work that's been done by researchers, brain scholars, who are studying the effect of meditation, when I watched this, I was thinking it on one level, you know, this is something that we can train our brains to do through meditation, through deep meditation. And I also thought, I don't know if I trust our brains or our subtle consciousness to sort of get us in the way without things like meditation or doing that level of training. So... I was wondering if you know where that intersection might be for researchers who are studying the effects and the ability of us to do things with our brain through meditation to sort of get to that inner landscape that I sort of get the feeling that we're sort of looking at here, but more that the externalization of it is what I see you doing. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not really knowledgeable about meditational research. What I've seen is... projects in which they try to use this technology to improve or to change meditation, and at first the potential users were a bit was kind of disruptions because they have to put this kind of technology, and it was not exactly the sort of context in which meditation would be favorable. But after a while, the technology fade in the background, and there was no influence of that. But apart from this, I don't know much about that kind of overlap. And I guess some people are trying to observe that and investigate that in research labs. But I don't know much about that.
I think there's definitely an overlap, and I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, just the creating, well, in a sort of very technical way, creating tools to help you train your mind to focus. And I think in the research community, so like scientists working in labs with like lab coats on and that kind of thing, they're trying to they can identify certain patterns of electrical activity that the brain generates, and they understand to a certain degree what those patterns represent, and so then they use those, and oftentimes it's just, you know, can you calm your brain so the electrical activity changes to a certain lower level, or it changes in a particularly recognizable way, and then they give you, you know, basically biofeedback to say, okay, you've now attained that state, and the interface sort of exists. It's very coarse and kind of crude, but I think it's also interesting to think about the way in which we kind of we see that effect, and then we sort of reinterpret it, and we understand, but it's not at the point where we understand exactly where our mind is going, I guess. So it is a kind of training because you just get that level of feedback, just like when you click on a thing on your computer and it does something, you're like, ah, got it, sorted out.
Hi, great presentation to you both. My question is a bit like the previous one. Do you know of any device, which device would you recommend as a do-it-yourself device for getting biofeedback on your brain state? So which kind of brainwave patterns do you have, including for meditation and things like that?
I really it's a little bit expensive, and I think someone's probably going to come out with something that does the equivalent, but it's a little bit cheaper. And I think it's expensive because it's sort of in the kind of scientific apparatus thing. But there's the REG by the company Siluron, which is the company that was spun off from the Engineering Anomalies Research Lab at Princeton, which they've since moved to Palo Alto, and so they have this REG device, okay, which. Is the random event generator, and they have software that you can hook it up to. And I think that's the one that I think, because to me it's like closest to the metal. In other words, it's generating random numbers, and you can see on a screen the influence, and you know, record it over time. You can use it in a lot of different ways, and it doesn't require a helmet or you to shave your head or open your skull. So that's
okay.
Very expensive.
And how much does it cost approximately? You know.
Sorry.
How much does it cost approximately?
I think it's like $300 for the device.
And for headsets, like the one I've shown, it's between $100 and $500.
Okay. Great. Thanks.
Sure.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm working on augmented reality. And in augmented reality, the holy grail is the augmented goggles, which should be available sometimes at the end of the year or next year. And when you have those goggles, the problem is that you need to interface with what you're seeing. So the mind control would be a really good application for this. How far do you see a technology that would allow to put mind control sensor in glasses in a discrete manner?
Well, the problem is mostly about the computation, because you can have the sensors on your head and the glasses. The data analysis should be somewhere else.
You will always, even for augmented reality, you have your smartphone in your pocket and it's connected in Bluetooth with the glasses. So
yeah, or like Siri, a voice control interface, but it's not, the computation is not local. So I would say that this is the main limit. And I can't predict the future.
3 years.
But we need 30 years.
3 years.
2 years?
Yeah.
I would have said four.
Oh, okay. Between 3 and 4 years.
But the needs are quite limited. You need to be able to type something by thinking and to activate some action. So
just make sure that you type the right thing.
Yeah.
Don't make sure you don't type your weird fantasy about your office mate.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So I think we're all pretty aware that Moore's Law is accelerating a lot of things right now, and we're seeing this convergence of mobile, social, geolocation, the rise of human-computer interfaces, and it's like all these things are accelerating at an exponential rate, and we're coming to a point where biotechnology, or our biology is really the limitation. I'm curious to your thoughts on when we get to a point where, like on that film you showed, where we'll see people that really kind of are like technology Amish. They go to a certain point, they'll carry a cell phone, but they won't take in nanobots, or they won't have bionic limbs. And what will happen in our society when we have these kind of two separate groups of people? You'll have like the X-Men, right? These mutants that have taken technology, have grown and adapted themselves, and then you have humans. And I'm curious to your thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's going to be as much a shit show as it is now. It's going to be like, there'll always be that. I mean, hopefully not always. And I think part of the point is to just sort of, either aspire to something different or just be aware that these evolutions are happening, these sort of developments, and that the, I think the only thing that could really, one of the things that could maybe make it, the landing softer in a way, is just recalibrating sort of our technological hubris, and understand that, you know, life is life, perhaps, and that just wanting to make it better by enhancing our ability to manipulate the world might not be the only strategy for the, you know, the only purpose for technology.
Sure. I just have a quick comment. On one of the previous workshops, there was a Toyota had gotten together with a bicycle designer and also another electronics guy, and they had put together a bicycle that you could change the gears with your mind. So they did the whole, they did it, the guy who described it to me, it was quite simple, it wasn't that hard to do, he kind of did it off the shelf, he didn't create it. So I think there are now, but you did have to train your mind to do it. You had to train the technology to your mind to make it happen. Mm-hmm. So I think it's here, and people are using it.
And this is not easy. The training part, yeah, it sounds easy, but it's not.
He might be existing on a higher plane. Cool. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thanks.